All right, hello everyone. We introduced ourselves earlier today, but since there's a lot of new faces, we thought we'd introduce ourselves again. My name is Rabia, and I'm president of the Biology Society.
And my name is Nita, and I'm the vice president of the Biology Society.
And I'm Ryan, and I'm the VP Finance of the Biology Society.
So on behalf of the Society, I would like to welcome you all to Evergreen, or welcome back. First off, the Biology Society has been a long time established club and has really taken pride in running events for its students. This year, we decided to launch an environmental campaign of events and therefore form the subcommittee of Biosphere, not only to spearhead the organization of this event, but also to get general members of the Biology Society involved.
And this year, Biosphere has done a great job. They've launched numerous events, and this has included the tomato and flower plant giveaways, the campus cleanup, and also an environmental movie series featuring films such as The 11th Hour, all in an effort to raise awareness amongst the student body about environmental issues.
And as a summation to all these events this year, we've taken upon ourselves to organize today's conference, featuring professors from all faculties of McMaster, speaking from different perspectives about the environmental challenges we face. And we certainly had some amazing speeches earlier today. And coming up right now is our guest speaker, Rex Weiler, who is the co-founder of Greenpeace. So stick around.
I'd just like to reintroduce our MCs who've MC'd this entire conference today, and will continue to do so. Their names are Laura Wieland, and she is the VP Communications for the Biology Society, as well as the Environmental Coordinator for Biosphere. And alongside her is Caitlin, a member of the Biosphere Committee. Thank you.
Hello. Rex Weiler is a journalist, writer, and ecologist. He was born in Texas and came to Canada in 1972. Between 1974 and 1982, he served as a director of Greenpeace, editor of the Greenpeace Chronicles magazine, and was a co-founder of Greenpeace International. He sailed on the first Greenpeace whale campaign, and his photographs and news accounts of Greenpeace appeared worldwide. His photography and essays have been published in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and National Geographic, among others. Rex is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author and co-founder of the Hollyhock Educational Center, which remains Canada's leading educational retreat center on professional, environmental, and personal studies. His book, Greenpeace, How a Group of Ecologists, Journalists, and Visionaries Changed the World, recounts the first decade of Greenpeace. Currently living in Vancouver, he remains active in environmental work and writes for magazines, newspapers, and Deep Green, which is a monthly feature found on the Greenpeace website. So without further ado, Rex.
Great, thank you very much. This has been an amazing day. I hope those of you who have been able to be here all day have heard some really important perspectives from all the faculties. It was great to hear Dr. Pearson this morning to bring culture and religious and moral beliefs into this issue. And we've heard some great data and information. History. It was great to listen to Michael Egan talk about the historical perspective and so forth. So I'll touch on some of those things as we go through. One of the things I believe is that we're in the middle of an economic collapse. This economic collapse has biophysical underpinnings. I believe that this economic collapse is at its base, at its roots, is an ecological collapse, and I will talk about why I believe that. And one thing I've noticed with all the speakers today, and myself included, is that we all want to be positive, we all want to be optimistic and make you feel better, and yet a lot of the data and a lot of the information that we're bringing to you is very troubling. We were talking about this this morning on our way in here, about always trying to be optimistic, and sometimes, I want to say a lot. I think first and foremost, we're at a university where we want the facts, we want the data, we want the information. So first of all, we want realism. And I think that without realism, our optimism can be delusional. And we want to avoid false solutions and delusion. So we'll start with realism. One of the things, back in the 50s, in the 1950s, Paul Sears made the comment that ecology was going to prove to be the subversive subject, the subversive science. And I think that we believed this in the 1970s when Greenpeace was started, and the reason it's going to be the subversive science, it's going to undercut everything else we do. Because throughout human history, we have kind of developed this concept and this idea that we are masters of our environment. And what we're going to learn through ecology is that we're not masters of our environment at all. And that we are, in fact, embedded in a biophysical system, and that we're going to have to learn from it. We're not just going to whip it into shape or manage it. One of these concepts of having a new perspective, I seriously believe that humanity, and each of us as individuals, we have to go through a paradigm shift of really unprecedented proportions. Certainly as profound as the paradigm shift in the 16th century when Copernicus and then later Kepler and Galileo pointed out that the whole universe may not be going around us, that in fact we may be orbiting the sun. At the time, you have to understand, in the 16th century, this was a profound idea, and people had a very hard time getting it through their heads that this might be possible. And I think that we're going to have to get a similar paradigm shift in our time. And just as Copernicus showed that we're not the center of the universe, I think ecology is going to show us that we're not the center of life on the planet, and the rest of the life on the planet does not revolve around our needs. So as a part of this perspective, this is our neighbor, M101. But if you were on M101 looking back towards us, this is roughly what you'd see, and our little planet would be about here on a little star, fairly insignificant little star out here on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. And one way to get a new perspective about the Earth is to imagine discovering a place like this. Imagine coming through space, looking for life in the universe. You know, people say, is there life in outer space? Well, there's at least us. We're as much in outer space as anybody else. But imagine discovering a place like this. Imagine flying in here and going, wow, look at that. There's water. There's air, oxygen. There's things are going to be living here. And just imagine the awe that we would have if we ever found a place like this in space. Imagine imagine being from somewhere else and arriving on this planet and finding this. It would be the biggest headline in the history of our world if we found this sort of a place. With life forms, these amazing life forms. How did that happen? How does nature do that? Well, we have a pretty good idea. We think we understand evolution. We understand how these things can happen, but it's still a miracle. It's a phenomenon. And I feel like falling back in love with nature is part of the challenge of our age, that we've put so much faith in technology and innovation in ourselves that we've forgotten just how magnificent, how beautiful this is. It's just phenomenal. And that all this happened here over the last 500 million years, but most of these changes over even the last 50 million years. And so imagine, you know, this is a Huli woman, by the way, from New Guinea. So when we talk about sustainability, here's another thing we have to think about is, I've heard a lot of the speakers today talk about what is real sustainability. So that we're not fooling ourselves, we're not being delusional about sustainability. When we talk about it, do we think buying a new Prius is sustainability? Are we going to get there that way? I don't think so. So I think that what we have to do is, somehow, we have to flip our whole way of thinking around. We have to start with nature. We have to start with this beautiful planet and work back up to human civilization. I don't think we're going to take little baby steps from modern human civilization and sort of quibble our way back to sustainability. I think we're going to have to ask some hard questions about what sustainability is. Anyway, I want to move to modern human civilization. There you go. This is me and my sister Kay. This is in 1952. You can see I was already depleting the environment. But I want to tell you a little story about this because it was my first awakening about ecology. This is in Wyoming. I was actually born in Colorado, but when I was young, I lived in Wyoming. I emigrated to Canada in 1972. And we were, I grew up in these are the prairies, sort of like south of Winnipeg in Wyoming. You can see the dry hills. And I grew up in this environment, I fell in love with the world. I fell in love with the environment. I just loved being in nature. I loved the birds. I loved being in the hills all alone. My sister and I used to go for long walks in the hills, and we were avid fishers. But one summer, I had two brothers as well. And one summer, my sister and my two brothers and I discovered a pond near our home. We had moved to Oklahoma. And we discovered a pond near our home, and we went to that pond, and we began to catch these huge catfish. And it was so exciting for us. We were young, and we'd bring these catfish home and bring dinner home for the family, and it was just such a wonderful experience to be providing dinner for our family. But here's what happened. In one single summer, we fished out this pond. And by the end of that summer, there were no more catfish. We couldn't catch any catfish in this pond. And I remember, and I think at that time I would have been 10 or 11 years old, and I just remember this sort of aha moment of realizing, oh my God, like we can actually get to the end of it. And I was just devastated by that. And it was a good lesson for me, and I carried it on. But as I got into junior high school, I did this experiment, and many, perhaps some of you have done it. This is our friend, Mr. and Mrs. Melanogaster. And we did this experiment where we put 8 fruit flies in a jar with a tomato, and we started charting how many, and we had this little method of counting them because we could force them from one container into the other so we could count them. And we got about this far, and I remember the professor saying, okay, where do you think this line is going to go? Well, of course, a lot of people, thought, well, maybe it'll go there. But some of us were in had studied math, and we knew about the doubling times, and we figured out the doubling times, and we knew that you could see it took a little while to get going, but once it got going, it was doubling in about every 5 days. So we figured out that, in fact, this line was going to go there. And in fact, now there's an issue about this area under the curve, and I won't go into it right now. We'll get into it later. But this area under the curve actually stands for something very important. And we'll get into this in a minute. But in this case, it would stand for fruit fly days. But that's also a proxy for the amount of the tomato it was eating. It's also a proxy for the biomass of the fruit flies and so forth. So sure enough, the fruit fly population went on this exponential curve. And then our teacher, Mr. Ryan, our science teacher, says, where do you think it's going to go now? Well, the amazing thing is that we went home for a weekend, and we came back after a weekend, and this is what had happened. This was more or less my second lesson in you can get to the end of it. This is what happens in a biophysical system. And if you go back to here, from this point, in every biophysical system, there are only two futures. Can this keep going on forever? No, it cannot. And whether you have mussels on a seashore or fruit flies in a jar or bacteria in a petri dish, this cannot continue. There's only two futures. Either it levels off and finds homeostasis, or it crashes. And of course, the fruit flies crashed. And so this was also about the time, this was the time when humanity first reached the moon. When I was in high school, I was a math and physics student, and I was all excited going to university, and I was going to go to, I wanted to get into aerospace, and we were all excited. It was like a time where we thought we could just do anything, and it was also the time we were first seeing these photographs, by the way. We had never before seen photographs of the Earth. Now, many of you grew up seeing photographs of the Earth. I didn't grow up seeing photographs of the Earth. The first time we saw it, I was in university. And when we saw these pictures, it was just mind-blowing. And this, again, we were confronted by this reality that we are this little pond in space. And it's hard to imagine that when we're wandering around Hamilton or at university, and there seems like this whole big world, but we are a little pond in space. But here's what was happening at the same time. And this was a picture that I saw in a newspaper when I was at university, I think in my third year. I was studying math and physics, and I wanted to be an engineer, and I was so excited about, we thought we were going to reconcile relativity and quantum physics, and we thought we were going to send human colonies to Mars and so forth. Back on Earth, this is what was happening. This is the Cuyahoga River in Ohio. It caught on fire when I was in college, and I saw this picture in the newspaper, and I just thought, oh my God, this is what it's come to. The rivers are burning. And I thought, this is it. Everybody's going to wake up. Everybody is going to notice that this has gone too far, that we haven't looked after things. And I just thought, for sure, this is it. People are going to notice. We're going to have a revolution. We're going to clean up the planet. And simultaneously at this time was the whole era of the nuclear weapons. And it seems so obvious to me as a young person that we can't blow ourselves up. And we knew about strontium-90. We knew that strontium-90, and this was something that Barry Commoner actually discovered in deciduous teeth of children in St. Louis, started noticing that there was strontium-90 and iodine in the teeth of children and in mother's milk. And so these nuclear weapons were, in fact, irradiating every living thing on the planet. Surely humanity's going to wake up and change. At about that time, I left the United States because I had been drafted to go to Vietnam War, and I just absolutely refused to go. I thought that was the stupidest thing anyone would ever do in their life, especially at that stage in history, would go to war. And I could have gone to jail in Texas, or I could have gone to the Vietnam War, so Vancouver looked pretty good by comparison.
Vancouver looked fantastic.
So I came to Vancouver. I've been living in Canada ever since. And this was our little group in Vancouver. Greenpeace actually started as an anti-nuclear group. And this was a picture taken in Washington when we actually climbed over the fence at the nuclear submarine base there and occupied the submarine base. And this is the Phyllis Cormac, the first Greenpeace boat, and off the coast of British Columbia, when we went out for the whale campaign. Now, here's what was going on. We were trying to stop nuclear weapons on the one hand, and on the other hand, there were many of us in the group who felt that what was really needed on planet Earth at this time was an environmental revolution. We had lived through civil rights, women's rights. It just seemed like a natural step. Of course, we should end racial discrimination. Of course there should be women's rights. It was completely non-negotiable. It was obvious. And it was equally obvious to us that we had to have an environmental revolution. And yet, it's proven to be a lot harder than we thought. And to us, it was almost, surely people will get it.